Are you looking to learn more about investing in the Central Indiana real estate market? You've come to the right place. Welcome to the Indy Real Estate Investing Podcast with TNH Realty, where we discuss all things related to investing in the Central Indiana real estate market. Thank you for listening and enjoy the show.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Indy Real Estate Investing Podcast. I'm your host, Jeremy Tallman with TNH Realty. We are a residential property management company that services the Central Indiana market. The title of this podcast is Why Educated Investors Are More Successful Investors. And with me to discuss this topic a bit is the co-founder of Roots Realty here in Indianapolis, and that's Tyler Lingle. Welcome to the show, Tyler.
Thanks so much, Jeremy, for having me. Excited to be here.
Yeah. So, Tyler, we met a couple of months ago. I've got to know you a little bit. I think you have an interesting story. I don't know what like the common background of a real estate agent looks like education-wise or whatever. I know a lot of agents. They all seem to have very dissimilar backgrounds. But you have a background in education, and I think that's really interesting. I think that gives you a unique skill set, particularly in capacity as an agent, a buyer's agent focused real estate agent. And I think that, again, that gives you the ability to have your buyers excel in other ways agents may not be able to do. So that's why I had you on here mainly. But I also think you have a lot of other things to talk about. I want to get into that a little bit. So tell everyone about you. Tell everyone about Tyler, how you, again, with your that background in education, how you got into that, and then what ultimately led you into real estate.
No, yeah, I appreciate the background information for people there. My bio on LinkedIn says educator, connector, then realtor. And that's how I see myself, is educator, then connector, then realtor. So I don't see myself as a salesperson first. But in terms of background, how I got there, I actually graduated from college with a social studies education degree. And started out of college at a charter school, making, you know, low 30,000s per year. And really was just super inspired to go change struggling disadvantaged areas in Indianapolis through education, through being a history teacher, about talking about our past and where we're going. And what I found was it's a really hard medium, public education, to change the world. Mm-hmm. And I kind of just ran into heavy bureaucracy. I got in trouble for motivating students by like rewarding them by taking them outside if they finished all their work early. Mm-hmm. I was punished, and yet my students were performing much harder in my class than all the other classes when I looked at them. And they all couldn't wait to go to Mr. Lingle's class. And so that was kind of just the final straw of like, you know, I don't think this is how we're going to change the world. And I've always been more motivated by impact than money. I believe if you're having the right impact, you can find ways to monetize yourself along the way if you're providing an abundance of value. So luckily I had that mentality kind of going into real estate. But what got me into real estate was actually my first house. Mm-hmm. So after my first year of teaching, I was living at home. So I saved about half my salary just by default, living at home, parents paying for all the groceries. Mm-hmm. It was kind of easy. No rent. I'm looking right for that. And I had like $14,000, I remember. And I was like, can this buy me a home? And sure enough, like you can buy a home for $14,000. And I bought a home in Irvington. It was $118,000. Mm-hmm. And it was a complete cosmetic mess. The bathroom was gross. I remember that tub, just nasty, and like weeds growing all over the place. So we got it, and I put two roommates in, and I didn't know how special this was at the time, but they more than covered the mortgage. Mm-hmm. I was making $500 a month. Nice. With my roommates. Mm-hmm. And so I didn't even know the terminology house hack. I actually learned about it after I bought the house, but I was like, oh, ding, ding, like house hack. And then all these other content producers, I remember reading Set for Life by Scott Trench, the Bigger Pockets CEO, I think he is. That book changed my life, got me more kind of in the tilt towards real estate. But I realized like, oh, wow, I'm already on this path. I'm cash flowing my primary. Why don't I just keep doing this? Mm-hmm. And from the very beginning, it was long-term holds. Because I would drive to work from the east side to the west side. I worked on the west side at a charter school. And I would see the east side flipping in front of my eyes. You know, yeah. I drive down New York Street, mm-hmm, or Michigan Street and be like, oh, there's another street, Chester. You know, there's another one, Tacoma. And I was like, why? why can't I get one of these and just ride off this crazy appreciation and market change in Indianapolis? So I think there was this deep desire to build wealth and then also combine it with my education background and help others do the same. And fortunately, I now get to do that. I have to pinch myself that that's my job.
Yeah. So when did you get a license? Like when did you enter the real estate business?
Yeah. So it was actually, I remember this, it was August of 21. My first two deals were my own rental properties. Mm-hmm. I was the agent and they were my own. They were both with partners. One was more of a debt partner. They loaned me some money. I was going to pay them an interest rate and hopefully make the delta on what I was paying them and what the property would return. And then one was a quad. And that was actually a house hack. My partner got the mortgage as a primary. He never actually lived in it, but he did have intent to stay right there from time to time. He was living at home with his parents. So house hacking is really how we got started in kind of being that investor agent. So I think it's been like 3 full years in the business. So I've kind of been strapped down. It's been moving quick.
Right. Yeah. I know you've made a name for yourself in this industry and in this market particularly. And congrats on that. I want to dig into that a bit because you've done a really good job. You talk about the education, right? And I think that is so fundamental to what we do as buyer's agents that represent investors. There's so much education. I look at it from the property management perspective. Forget about, say they come to us with a house, right? There's so much education, particularly for new investors, that we have to do to make sure they're really set up for success, because there's so many expectations out there. Some of those expectations aren't the best. So if you have the right expectation, and I think it starts with a real estate agent, everybody's happier. So you do several things. I want to go through those here. You have a newsletter, and you know, about 3 or 4 years ago, my perspective on newsletters was that they're not effective, they're noise. And I think most of that was because the content was terrible, right? We were all on those mailing lists, and realtors are as bad as anybody. Their lenders are probably right there with them that just provide canned junk that will go literally from your inbox right to your trash. You don't read them because it's all just, there's no emotion in it. There's no value in it. It's, you know, spring tips, winter tips, whatever. There's not a lot of value in them. But more recently, we've seen it in our industry. I think you've seen it too. And you've created some newsletters that you don't get from AI. You don't get from, you know, some syndication. You actually put thought into it and you write about things that investors want to read about. And as a result, you get traction from that. It doesn't matter the medium, I don't think, from whether it's video or whatever. If you create good content, you're going to get listenership, readership, whatever. So talk about your inspiration for a newsletter, because you're a young guy. I don't think newsletters, you know, not to stereotype your generation, but there's a lot of TikTok, a lot of Instagram. I'm sure you are involved in that. But newsletters are basic, like just good fundamental marketing. Talk about your motivation to do that. And you do a great job. You put a lot of content out. So talk about why you started that.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's been scratching my own itch there. When I broke into real estate, kind of as an investor, I was like, where's the source of indie knowledge? Mm-hmm. And I realized people would say, oh, you can read the IBJ or, oh, you can go to Saria, and but it's maybe a little watered down, maybe a lot of beginners there. And I was just like, oh, there's not really much here mm-hmm. besides coffee meetings with people. So right. I kind of started on this coffee meeting spree where I would meet guys like you, Nick Giuliani, other, you know, Brian Snyder, other people yeah. in the business, kind of in this indie real estate niche, especially residential. And then I had this yearning of being kind of a facilitator, being kind of a node in the system. I had this desire, and I think it comes down to my identity as an educator, connector, then realtor, this connector piece, wanting to be the central node and kind of wanting to clarify what I was seeing going on in Indianapolis in this, you know, the broader commercial development, but then also the waves it was making in residential. And so I remember I called it the Indie Investor Update. Mm-hmm. And at the beginning, it was more of broker blasts, like buy this deal, because I was kind of in grind mode, just trying yeah. to pay my mortgage at this time. And then it evolved, and you know, people kept saying, like, keep doing this. We like your commentary. We like your explanation. We like the peek inside your brain on what you're seeing. We have other jobs out in 9-to-5 world. We're not in this real estate world. So I started to pivot more towards just being like a investment residential newsletter, and still include some deals, because I think people see them informationally. Like, what is a good deal right now on the market? Mm-hmm. And Peter Lohman, who is a property manager in Columbus, had an awesome podcast on the Millennial Investor Podcast. And he says, niche down to scale up. And at the beginning, you know, I think a lot of agents are trying to be luxury investor. And then also the first time, they're all over the place because they just want to get deals. I realized I need to stay in this lane because people are demanding this content and I need to fill this void. So it's done that. It's grown to almost 1,000 subscribers in, you know, 2 years. So I think there's a lot of demand for it, and I'm excited to see where we'll go.
Yeah, that's great. 1,000 subscribers in 2 years. That's amazing. So kudos to you for that. It's, again, it's about, I think it is interesting. You mentioned people want your insight, right? And because that's what people want to read. They don't want to read just, we can all provide statistics, and I know we do a lot of that, you know, because I do think that there's some value in knowing what rental trends are looking like. But the inside commentary is what people want, because you are the boots on the ground person that lives and works in Indianapolis every day. And your insight is valuable to people, right? Especially if you perform and you can build the trust. So that's great stuff, Tyler. Appreciate that. Secondly, you have an event, and full disclosure, we're sponsors of your event now. And talk about that. I mean, you have multiple events throughout the year. I know you're still trying to maybe build a cadence that you guys are comfortable with, but talk about what led to that and what all's involved with it.
Yeah. Again, once I broke into real estate, I looked around and I was like, where is the centralized source of these meetups and meeting investors and networking and learning new things? And I was like, it's just not there. Mm-hmm. And so that was kind of the tap on the shoulder of like, you should do this. So my first one, no sponsors, you know, a tiny little room inside the brewery, not the main hall. And it was packed out. And everyone was telling me, when is the next one? They would ask me at the end of the night, when's the next one? And I was like, there's no plan. I have no next one. I didn't know if there would ever be a next one. But then once we started to scale up the Roots Realty team, which is a team that I founded that's kind of focused on investment, real estate, and building wealth, we had the capacity to go more consistent. And now our goal is to do 4 of them a year, so about once a quarter. And we put on kind of a panel or a one-on-one interview with someone kind of with a big name. So there's some entertainment. Everyone gets a free drink ticket. You put on a name tag with, you know, your name and then what you're kind of known for. Are you a property manager? Are you an investor agent? Whatever you are. And the goal is to set up coffee meetings to maybe, you know, find a property manager. I mean, obviously the sponsors, you guys are a sponsor. They're all people that we have vetted and highly recommend to kind of build out your team, but to also get the lay of the land. You know, is single family more hot? Is multifamily? Where's a good area to flip? You know, rent rates, how do I judge those? Where are those going in the future? Where are vacancy rates? And I think it's that centralized place, not to say there's not other centralized sources of information in need, but I think we seem to be veering towards being one of the main ones, mm-hmm. if not the main one. And that's my goal. I get a lot of joy of that, of just that education of like, I get it now. And I think it's because I just didn't know. It took me a full year or more to get my compass oriented. And I worked in it every day. So I'm thinking about that person that has a 9-to-5 job that wants to build financial freedom. It's just huge obstacles to even have the confidence to buy the first property.
Yeah.
So how can we be a stepping stool to get them confident so they have the right people and the right insights? That's the goal.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, I think you've done a good job of like not making it all about Tyler or Roots or whatever. You know, there's a lot of people from the industry that come into that meeting, right? And to make connections. And so sounds like you've done a great job in kind of priming that pump for that interaction to happen. That's great. You talked a little bit about earlier about your personal investments and your strategy. I think it's interesting because I think Scott and I have very similar thoughts around what's the best way to get into real estate. And that's the beauty of real estate. There's so many ways you can go. short term wasn't a thing when we started. It certainly is a thing now. But, you know, we built our business on buying those long term rentals. We did a ton of flipping. I think I've documented that a lot. But for you and how you advise clients, you mentioned long term, right? Because real estate can be a tough business. If you look at it from a month to month, year to year, things like that, you know, the example of, well, I own one rental property and I had to do a $7,000 HVAC system. Your year's done. There's no coming back from that, right? There's no way. But if you own that property 10 years, 15 years, 20 years, to me, that's where the wealth comes. That is our ideal client from T&H's perspective of someone that views real estate as a long-term wealth building activity. It's literally, we boilerplated that on our VTO for you traction people. You'll know what I'm talking about there. But how do you advise people? Like because you have your own philosophy. So how does that work into your pitch? I hear there's a guy named Tyler Lingle in Indianapolis that's helping investors. I want to call Tyler. I set a meeting with you. Talk to me about, and I'm looking for some best strategies in Indianapolis. What's your pitch? Like, what is your philosophy?
Yeah, I think from the very beginning, when I jumped on those intro calls with investors, it was not, you know, here's how to get rich quick. Here's how to flip. I was almost repelled away from that mm-hmm. just because it felt high risk and maybe high reward, but just very high risk, especially for newer investors. I firmly believe in the 50-year play in Indy. I think Indy will be in a much better spot in 50 years, at least 30 years, let's be honest. I mean, 50 years, who knows what could happen.
It's a long time.
The world could be burning down by then at this rate. But the 30-year play in Indy, right now, I just saw CBRE released a deck on the developments just downtown, just the mile square. It was $10.3 billion or something like
that.
It's
insane.
You know, just with all that they're pumping out, Purdue University is building their own campus, you know, Elanco, 16 Tech, IU Health, the largest medical development currently in the nation. Like, what they're doing, the skyline is literally changing at a very rapid pace. And I think there will be many people telling you or I, like, you know, that was genius to buy real estate. I think it's obvious.
Yeah, it is.
I think it's absolutely obvious if you look at just what real estate has done in the past 50 years nationwide, that you buy in areas where population and employment prospects are growing. Indianapolis is, it might be the best city in the nation for stability, employment, population growth. I know our population growth rate is the strongest in the Midwest. I just looked at that. That was in the deck. So zooming, you know, back into the investment lens, my sort of pitch was invest in growing neighborhoods. Where do you see that commercial development happening? Where is the buzz around town? And a lot of these out-of-state investors especially, they had no clue. They couldn't tell Garfield Park separate from Riverside. They would have no, just looks like an old house to them with a price tag. But I could tell them, Riverside, it's early, but you're going to have a median price of about 130. That's going to hopefully grow, you know, about to this amount with a lot of cash flow versus Garfield Park's more established. It's more of a stable with more appreciation maybe than cash flow. And breaking that down, so both I think are great investments. It just depends on what your risk reward, your cash flow needs versus, you know, parking your money in a more stable asset. So I think gentrifying neighborhoods, revitalizing neighborhoods was kind of what I wanted to specialize in. I bought all of my properties in those, in areas where I thought the top end was much higher than it was currently. And that made cash flow possible because I'm not buying in the Broad Ripple now. Broad Ripple right now is like a class A neighborhood. It's very pricey. Single family homes are $300,000. You will lose money every month owning it. It's much like owning real estate in Chicago.
Right.
More similar to that. So I didn't understand doing that, of course. I wanted to make money every month, not lose money every month. So I bought in these growing areas. So I bought south and east of Fountain Square, around Irvington, now a little bit in that Fall Creek area. And those are the areas that I tell investors, buy here. And I promise you will thank me in 5 years. Mm-hmm. I promise you, and I could be wrong. That's somewhat risky to say. It's for sure going to go up. But I think all the markers are pointing in the right direction.
Right. So you look for areas where you see, again, commercial development, population growth, things like that, and say, there's still value here. Those are becoming harder to find, right? When we first started, Fountain Square was like, you don't go there, if you can believe that, right? I mean, it's totally changed now. We bought a ton of stuff, still own a lot of stuff in South Broad Ripple. we considered South Broderville 52nd to 46th, Keystone to College. That was South Broderville. I know it's a very loose term, but that's, and it was an up and coming area. And some of the prices we paid back then would probably, it might shock you, maybe it wouldn't, but we got in at that time. We felt like it was an area to invest in, and it's really done well for us. So there's a lot of other areas like that. I think it's exciting to see that stuff go on. But again, it becomes harder and harder to pinpoint those. And that's why boots on the ground are so important. So tell me, Tyler, interest rates are high right now compared to we're at the highest point we've been in 20 some years. How are you advising people today? Like if someone calls you and says, look, I really want a cash flow, which is hard right now, right? So what's your advisement on how to deal with these interest rates and still buy?
No, it's a great question. I have seen investor activity go down, I'll be honest. But I think the ones that buying, I agree absolutely that the goal right now is to buy for equity, buy a deal for a deal, and then cash flow should improve in the future. What I mean is if rates are lower, well, every 1% rates go lower. I've heard that 5 million buyers nationwide enter the market. Mm. And I've experienced that, right? It was a frenzy when I first jumped in and I didn't even know what I was doing, but people were like, write an offer on this. I didn't even have to send the deals out. They were just sending the deals to me and I was writing offers all day. So you can only imagine how much premium people were paying. 20, 25,000 over ask was extremely common on a good deal.
Yeah.
To the point where it became a bad deal often. Whereas now, especially in the investment marketplace, maybe not so much for the Class B areas, but for, you know, Class C and single family homes especially, I think there's a really good opportunity to buy a deal that in 2 years will be worth a lot more. Mm-hmm. Especially if you can do some work to it, and especially if you're in a developing, growing neighborhood, of which I believe there are many in Indy. And I do believe the rent rates are going up a lot. I looked at the data and I saw the past 3 years, and it might have slowed down recently, was like above 10% year over year. 2022 was 14%. And the reality is there's still not enough affordable housing in Indy for just the growth of our economy and in our population. So I think you have to zoom out. Year one's going to be probably your worst year. Year two might not be much better, but I think year three and beyond is really where you see the returns in that equity gain, in that cash flow starting to get better and better. I think to mitigate right now, what you need to do is either put more money in the deal, or you need to be okay with flat returns at the beginning.
Right.
Because I think this is a long game with a lot of the ROI coming in at the tails.
Yeah. So your sales pitch to me, if I came to you, would be cash flow may not exist for a while, but you think I'm getting some good deals today because once those interest rates start to trek down, which they probably will, let's be honest, eventually they will, that equity will rise. Right?
Absolutely.
And rent rates should rise. So if I have the ability to float, you know, a property or two, if I got a portfolio that's performing really well and I say, look, I want to mix in a couple of properties so I can get some equity built up more quickly with these, today's the time to buy it. We have actually had that same conversation, Tyler, internally. I think there's something to it. I think interest rates are going to be pivotal to making that work.
Yep.
Right? Because I think initially we thought 2024, we'd see right out of the gate, a bunch of breaks, and we haven't seen that yet. So we'll see how that works out. I do think that the last word from the Fed was that their next move will be a reduction. It won't be an increase. So that's good to see. So your thing is cash flow right now isn't a thing to focus on. It's more equity building.
It's just not a cash flow market when you're at an 8% rate. It's not going to be really ever at these relatively high rates. So I do think it's buy for a better deal. You have less competition. You'll have more chance to get it under asking.
Right.
I think it's leverage the situation. Yeah.
Yeah. Talk about, you talk to a lot of investors. You've been doing this for a few years now. You're starting to develop some, you know, you're probably people you helped 2 or 3 years ago. You're seeing some results. Right? They're starting to feel, okay, this is how this property's performed, things like that. And you probably have a lot of different personality types you deal with, I'm sure. What are some of the bigger mistakes you see investors make, even in the short time you've been doing this? Like, what mistakes are you seeing, and what are you trying to educate people to help avoid making those mistakes?
Yeah, I think that the bigger pockets phenomenon made everyone very model and number sensitive and get pretty heady about it. I think it's funny, in the Robert Kiyosaki days, he wrote Rich Dad, Poor Dad, it was more, I guess, a little more intuitive. And now it's become extremely numbers driven. You've seen the rise of the Burr movement, which is very numbers driven, and it's about recycling the capital and the velocity of money. David Green has spoken about that at length. So I think that Burr phenomenon, that bigger pockets phenomenon, has been relatively a good thing, but I think we swung too far in that direction. I had people that were looking at, numerous people that were looking at Kansas City, Cincinnati, Louisville, and Indianapolis at the same time.
Right.
So you can only imagine how much I had to downgrade them in my priority list, because you know, they'll probably buy a property 3 hours away from here, you know, if I don't deliver them one that matches exactly their criteria. And it became all about the numbers. I think the best investors gain market expertise in their area, build up a name for themselves, and they get more deals sent to them. They just build more connections. Again, it's that long-term, long-tails-focused effort there, which is what I'm trying to do, is just invest in Indy long-term, become an expert in the area, get access to better deals. So I think making it all about a spreadsheet is the number one issue I'm seeing. I have seen people buy properties that back up to an interstate or really close to an airport when there was a really good other deal that was maybe $15,000 more in a much better area, that I think the appreciation and the tenant quality would have been enormously better. But that 15 grand was the difference between a 6% cash on cash and a 3%. So they went for the 6%. But in reality, will it actually perform as a 6%? There's so many intangibles in real estate that are, it's real estate. It's 3D. It has a name and a place. And if you're not there looking at it, thinking, would I actually live here and want this real estate if I was a buyer in the future, I think you can make some mistakes.
Yeah, that's so good. Like that whole notion of, all right, I got two properties. They're both 1,500 square feet, three bedroom, two baths. And I can buy this one for $100,000, or I can buy the other one for $140,000. Or let's say 100, let's use your example, $115,000. You obviously, most investors are going to lean toward the 100, but having that boots on the ground experience and really understanding, because it's not necessarily about, yes, you residents will be, you're going to have a harder time finding a resident that backs up to an interstate, period, right? But you're also on your long-term, your in-game solutions, you're going to have a hard time selling that to a retail buyer to get maximum value, because let's face it, the best in-game, I think, for single-family investors is to sell it to a homeowner. You're probably going to get your highest and best number to selling it to a homeowner. So that homeowner may not, or most homeowners would not want to have a home that backs up to an interstate. It's so intuitive. But if you're just looking at your numbers, it becomes problematic, and you get, and that's why I think the boots on the ground is so helpful to let you know, like, hey, that this is a problem. And maybe an interstate's not a good example, because they're going to be able to see an aerial. Sure. But maybe it's something just that they don't know about, a power line, whatever it is, the house next door, I don't know. There could be a lot of things that having someone look at the property and go, hey, I know it pencils out, but there's this and this. And so, again, staying away from those. I think that's a great point. I think spreadsheets, I think I mentioned this to you before, but when Scott and I first started buying rental properties, I don't know how many inputs our spreadsheet had, maybe like six, right? I mean, it was purchase price, rent, taxes, you know, things like that. It was very simple. And now I see these spreadsheets, and I think bigger pockets, like you mentioned, has a big part in that. They're just so sophisticated. I'll make this, and I could be wrong about this, but I think it's so hard if you have that mindset of long-term, right, to make a mistake buying real estate. I did a podcast, or I did a blog, I don't remember, on our big mistake we made in real estate. And that's when Scott and I got sideways on it. We had some mix up on what we were going to pay at an auction for a property. And we ended up paying, I don't remember the exact number, 17 or 19,000 more than we thought we should. We got our properties crossed. And we still own that property. It's worth a lot, and it's been a great cash flowing property for us. So it's like, that's our mistake, right?
Right.
And we're like so much.
It doesn't matter when you zoom out.
That's right.
Years and years and years. And that's what I'm trying to help people understand about Indianapolis is where we're going. These $100,000 properties can't possibly stay here. These $200,000 properties, when rates drop, I'll tell you what, there's a frenzy to buy them, especially the affordable ones that investors and lower income homeowners are trying to get. That they'll all be pushed up when rates drop. It's just the writing is on the wall.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Any other mistakes? You mentioned spreadsheets. Any other things you want to go over on just like things that you really advise people when they're buying?
Yeah, it's a good question. I would say the management. I would say not owning a property actively, especially when it's the beginning. I hired a property manager who was like my first connection in the business for my first property, which was a quad. And it was just like, have we leased this thing yet? What's happening? Waiting a week for an email response. The grass is growing tall. Have we got waiting a week for an email response? Couldn't get people on the phone. And I think this person hopefully has cleaned up their systems. I'm not going to name the business. Then moved over to the next company. They gave me a great sales pitch. Awesome, personable onboarding process, but then it was very similar. VAs doing the maintenance requests, not an actual employee in the United States, and just frustrations. I actually had a tenant go to jail. His dog crapped everywhere. It's a nightmare. I mean, just like you can imagine how bad that was. And so what I did was I realized no one's going to steward this asset like I am, and I need to figure this out. Mm-hmm. And then I can maybe hire a manager. And I see a lot of people buy, especially a more cash flowing, maybe Class C property, because the spreadsheet handed over to a third party manager with little due diligence, and they think it's going to work out amazing.
Right.
I see them come and I see them go really, really fast because they didn't understand what it took to be a successful real estate investor, which I think is hard. I think in 2024, it is not easy to be a real estate investor. I think it is extremely hard to make the numbers work. I think you have to hold on and push through to that decade plus hold. Mm-hmm. I think it gets really pretty. But I think in the short run, it is extremely hard. I've faced that myself. And when I self-managed, I did turn it around. But hard work, a lot of learning, setting up the rent ready, learning how to lease. I leased on Zillow myself. I vetted the tenants. I screened the tenants myself. I did the maintenance calls. I visited the property every week. It was annoying as hell. Mm-hmm. I'm just going to be honest.
Yeah.
Annoying as hell for making $200 a month on each door, maybe less. You know, I was just like, I could make money better ways. But it was the education. I wanted to have that experience of doing it. And then once I felt like I get this, I grasp it, I know what I need to do to hire a really good manager. I know how to manage the manager.
Mm-hmm.
Then I outsourced to managers, and I had a much better lens on what questions to ask, what to monitor. So I think picking a really good property manager, but also having the skills to know how to truly vet a property manager. I know this is your lane. You probably know even a lot more than me on this, but I had to learn the hard way on that.
Yeah. I mean, property management is a tough business. And I think a lot of people that get into management think, well, it can't be that hard. Our own personal story, you know, we managed our own properties for a long time. We felt we did a really good job of it. We did showings, we did screenings, we did make readies, we did everything. Scott and I did. So when we started doing third party, thought, well, this isn't hard. This is stuff we do every day. Well, it's really hard, especially when you're a fiduciary for somebody else. It puts extra pressure on it, and the reporting and the transparency and things like that just has to be way up front for people to start trusting you. And unfortunately, I don't think Indianapolis is different, but we've had some people come in and have a really nice shiny name and product and have a lot of business come in, and then it explodes. I mean, there's a lot of examples of that, a lot of recent examples, but it's been going on since we started. But you have to get really clear about what you expect out of a manager, because we tell people probably every day, we're not a good fit for you. Like, if you want to be involved in every decision we make, it's not a good fit. right? The classic example is screening. We don't give our owners the ability to choose tenants because fair housing would have a massive problem with that. So again, it's about choosing that management company that you're comfortable with, that has the same philosophy as you, that, because really it's a partnership. It should be a partnership. I would assume that you can make more money doing what you do today as opposed to managing your rental home, showing those properties, things like that. And that's why ultimately I think you hire a management company, is when your time becomes more valuable, right? And then, so you want to outsource it. So this is great, Tyler. Appreciate it. Tell people how they can reach you. You mentioned a newsletter. You mentioned this event. How do people get a hold of you and start subscribing? And then if you're local, attend your events.
Yeah, absolutely. So to get on the newsletter, which blasts out the events and educational content, and we have like a little investor map, and then I send a hot list of deals. You can go to tylerlingle.com. Maybe you can put that in the show notes.
Yeah.
That's how to get on the list, how to connect. I'm really active probably mostly on Instagram, although I'm also on Facebook and LinkedIn. The Instagram handle is Tyler_Lingle. I definitely love to talk about real estate way too much on there, but people seem to get a kick out of it. Yeah. So yeah, those would be the best places.
And then your event is
May 16th at 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. The panel discussion starts at 6:30 p.m. We have a short-term rental expert who owns like 50 plus. We have a Burr flip expert who's done, I guess, like 300 deals. And then another guy who's more of a creative finance agent guy. It's going to be interviewing them, taking audience questions. And that's at Guggenheim House Brewing.
Great. Well, appreciate it. Thanks for coming on, Tyler.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Good to see you again. We hope everyone has picked up some information that will help them in their investing. We'll be back in 2 weeks with another podcast. In the meantime, we encourage you to share this podcast with your investing friends. Leave us a review and don't hesitate to reach out to us with any questions. Until next time, thank you so much for listening, and please stay invested in your investment.